Welcome to World Anti-Extremism Network's scholarly podcast on ideas for countering extremism and authoritarianism. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the World Anti-Extremism Network's podcast. I'm your host, Ahrar Ramispour. Thank you for tuning in today's episode, From Authoritarianism to Violence, we examine how authoritarian regimes consolidate power and how their grip often turns violent, targeting dissent, silencing voices, and eroding basic freedoms. Joining us today is the director of Opposition International, a seasoned expert with over 30 years of experience in international relations. With a PhD in history and diplomacy, he leads a team of journalists and researchers reporting on democratic movements and challenges worldwide. His work spans strategic communications, diaspora engagement, and global democratic accountability. He has published widely on democracy promotion and political economy and continues to advise leaders and policymakers across regions. Together, we will delve into how authoritarian systems take shape, how they gradually erode freedoms, and the early signs that signal deeper repression ahead. We will also explore how communities, activists, and movements are pushing back, working to resist authoritarian rule and lay the foundations for more just, open, and accountable societies. Welcome to the program, Dr. Owen Leppard. Without further delay, let me begin with my first question. In your view, how do authoritarian regimes use violence as a tool of governance or control? Can you share examples where state violence became central to authoritarian rule?
Okay, well, thank you so much for having me on your program. I'm delighted to be here. So your listeners know, we've met before last year at your conference in Toronto. Now, I was particularly happy to receive the invitation today in order to address this topic of authoritarian governments and violence. I am currently in Dhaka, Bangladesh, working on a project with overseas voting. But today in Washington, my friends with Right to Freedom, Bangladeshis of America, and several other groups, Professor Sultana from Cornell, my very good friend, ex-deputy chief of mission, John Danilowitz, they are in Washington and they're addressing this very topic. What happened on July 15th in Dhaka? Well, the government of Sheikh Hasina was under serious siege in terms of public opinion because of some policy decisions that it made. Instead, and the government had become very authoritarian in its 15th year of existence, 16th year of existence, which in many cases rested upon questionable elections. And in the face of the protests, it actually had to do with the right of new students to apply for government jobs, because these government jobs were being reserved for the children of freedom fighters, but that definition had wandered because of various corruption. Anyway, they stood up to the government, and there were several critical moments where they came into confrontation with the security forces and the armed forces. The security forces did what security forces rarely do. They realized that, in fact, the public opinion was so overwhelmingly against any repression of the students that they, in fact, allowed for the protest to go forward. And what does that tell you? What it tells you about authoritarian governments and violence is an insight provided to us by Hannah Arendt, who was a famous American of German origin, scholar and of political science. And she made the observation that authoritarian governments turn to violence when they are weak, when they are losing. And because they are unable to maintain their authority through the traditional bureaucratic methods, they turn to violence. And in fact, in an authoritarian regime, violence is an extension of bureaucracy. Bureaucracy is the tyranny of nobody. And when that starts to break down, then that leads to violence. And what we saw last year on the streets of Dhaka, what we see in Iran, what we see in many other countries bears witness to the truth of Hannah Arendt's insight that essentially authoritarian governments turn to violence when they're losing power. Do you have any follow-up on that? I'm delighted to discuss other examples or go in more depth into that mechanism between bureaucracy and violence.
Thank you, Dr. Owen. I think you mentioned very key points regarding the authoritarian regimes, early signs of how they turn to violence. I think Bangladesh was a good example, and also Iran, as you mentioned. And I remember also in 2011, when the Syrian government, Bashar al-Assad, started suppressing civil activism of people who were in the streets, demonstrations carried out by groups of people protesting against the regime at that time. And then the regime started killing civilians, and finally we were witnessing big disaster in that country. There may be some other examples also maybe from other parts of the world, if you want to mention some other examples too.
Well, the most governments, even authoritarian governments, are reluctant to use force in this age when communications have become far more advanced. Perhaps before, when you could have political repression and use violent means to uphold it, and nobody really knew what was going on, there was greater scope for violence, or it could be contained, that you only needed as much as was necessary to hold back a protest. What's happened in an age of mass communications is that when there is the roots of opposition to an authoritarian government, that is known much broader and much more quickly than in the past. Therefore, violence is incrementally larger and more fierce and directed because the act of protest is far better known. And that's what makes political protest in this age actually more dangerous than it was perhaps before, because protests engender a much stronger, more widespread violent response. And again, you see this where violence begins in, let's say, the central part of a central city, but then spreads quickly to outer regions. I think, in fact, one of the underreported stories of what happened, for instance, in several countries in the Middle East, Syria being one of them, is that the protests outside Damascus, for instance, were just as fierce and directed and repressed as anything that was going on in Damascus. And so that's given that regional development a regional expansion of authoritarian violence is something that I believe will be studied more intensely as the years go by. I'd like you to hear your view on that, because in several countries where there is poor reporting or underreporting from regional cities and the protests are not widely covered, that the activities, both of protest and repression, violent repression, are stories that need to be told.
Yeah, Dr. Owen, I think in some cases, the authoritarian regimes, they're trying to use some other groups, some proxy groups, like militia groups or Islamist radical groups, in different type of groups, secret police, ununiformed police, to suppress the demonstrations and voices of people. If you collaborate a little bit about this topic also.
Well, the thing about secret police that's almost laughable is everybody knows who the secret police are. They stick out like sore thumbs. If they truly are secret police, you think people would know who they were. And this has been time and again a downfall or a weakening of authoritarian governments, is that, first of all, authoritarian governments have very low trust. They don't even trust their most closest associates. And hence you see this duplication of security services, because they don't believe that the security services themselves are loyal. So they create another level of security services to check the loyalty of the first level of security services. And it's that duplication of security services that leads to infighting, and usually that infighting within the authoritarian governments weaken them considerably. And therein lies, I think, an avenue for protest groups. Really, as much as they need to get their message out in favor of human rights and for the empowerment of the people, they also have to be strategic in trying to set the authoritarian governments against themselves, because their internal struggles are what will probably undo them in the long run, as much as any external protests.
Yeah, thank you. You touched upon a very critical and important issue, the lack of trust on their own followers, on their own people, that calls for establishing other layers of security or secret agents or secret forces for suppression of people. That was a very important point. Really, we have seen this kind of approach by these totalitarian regimes in different parts of the world, from Russia to Syria and former regimes to Iran. For instance, in Iran, there is official police, but there is also another group that called Hezbollah, kind of followers of the supreme leader of the regime, Sepahi Pasdaran and others. They are usually forcing people to be silenced, and also they are like a tool on the hand of the supreme leader for suppression of communities. Let's come on another topic or question about the justification. As we are witnessing in media sometime, or most of the time, that totalitarian regime, they are trying to justify their crimes against their nation, their people. What do you think about this kind of justifications? Usually they are saying this is security reason, national interest, or interference of foreign countries. These kind of justifications usually we are hearing through media. Well, what is your view on this?
I have a very distinct view on the misinformation and disinformation that authoritarian governments sometimes employ. Actually, they employ it all the time. It's misguided. They think that it is helping them by distracting the public from their own or repressive behavior. And the misinformation and disinformation is generally so obvious after a point that it's actually counterproductive. Now, the Russians have great misinformation, disinformation campaigns they run through Eastern Europe. And it may have had some initial impact. But the fact is, very quickly, the public becomes savvy to these kind of and disinformation campaigns. And so now I know there's something of a cottage industry out there now to point it all out. And I suppose, yes, it is necessary to do some good. But generally, the mis and disinformation of many of these groups is proof of their own inability to persuade the public. And I think when you, in certain countries, when mis and disinformation become wrapped up in religious justifications, that it can be very messy. But still, you see when in interviews from people who have fled from certain countries and the diaspora, that they are very cynical as to anything these authoritarian governments put forward. And they undermine their own credibility incredibly, and particularly in this age when information is so readily available. I think what we'll start to see is a speeding up of the cycle of decay you see with authoritarian governments. Where that cycle is not being spread quickly, is that usually there will be a certain amount of distrust between various social groups, and that the clever dictators are those that are able to take advantage of those ethnic, socioeconomic, religious schisms, which is technically, yes, it's technically through repression, but it's also through very skillful political maneuvering that I think those who are committed to a regime of resistance and to the promotion of civil liberties have to be aware of and cannot be unaware of these various ethnic, religious, social splits and have to leverage them themselves in a way to neutralize the polarizing effects of a regime. And that is one of the things that frankly, when you referred to your conference of last year, that I heard testimony by the Iranian women's group and some of the groups from other parts of South Asia and the Near East, where they were very keenly aware of that rather delicate balancing act.
Dr. Wayne, let's put the totalitarian and authoritarian regimes' violence in one side, since they are in power, they are suppressing people, they are limiting the civic space in certain societies or countries. In one hand, we have the international community, let's say the world, which these authoritarian regimes also have the membership of this big family of the international community. In most of the time, we have seen a kind of double standards dealing by the international community towards these authoritarian regimes. Sometimes they are trying to have their interactions and business relations, political relations with these kind of regimes. Sometimes they are paying less attention on some of these regimes. Sometimes they are taking some serious reactions, at least through the Security Council of the United Nations and some other sort of political actions in the global level. What do you think about the silence of international community towards atrocities, like, let's say, or any kind of behavior committing by the authoritarian regimes against their own population, against their own citizens? This kind of silence make them more brave to take more violence, to commit more violence against their people. What do you think about this?
States who are based on internal compromises themselves between various groups are reluctant to take a firm stand with other states that are manipulating the groups within their countries. The West has, however, set a standard of resisting and pointing out oppression that unfortunately it has not lived up to. That the ideals of the United Nations, for example, are regularly violated or ignored. You know, that's a tough one because there's all sorts of justifications. You know, it's for the greater good. We don't want to expose minority communities to even further repression if they're seen to be allied with foreign powers. And so the ability of the Western states, and by West, I mean, I include many states that are in fact not in the West. Japan, South Korea, many of the ASEAN states. You know, West is just a code word for states that adhere to the values of the UN Charter and to the basic framework that governments should be accountable. And it is a challenge for countries to be consistent. The United States and Canada, Great Britain, there are many examples of inconsistency. I don't think that will ever be overcome completely. It will be a long and difficult journey to try and impose consistent opposition to states that are violating international human rights by the treatment of people within their boundaries. I wish I knew the answer to that, you know? Exhortation, just keep bringing it up. It isn't going to go away, nor should it. Nor should there be any slacking off of trying to expose situations where there is repression. And it will be an ongoing struggle. If you look at the last 100 years, there has been progress made. And maybe that progress is made in centuries, not in decades. That's not as optimistic as I would like to be, but it may be the reality.
Dr. Wendt, I think we are in the last minutes of the program. We have 2-3 minutes more. If you elaborate a little bit about the role of civil society, how the civil society groups, academics, academic institutions, they can play their role to prevent the escalation of violence in authoritarian settings. Is it possible? How do you see?
You know, that's a big topic, but there's one thing I want to say about it. What is civil society? It is society in which there are associations that say and supposedly adhere that we don't want the government to organize our affairs when it comes to certain issues of human rights and democracy, that in fact we don't trust the government to be as consistent and as diligent in the preservation of rights and democracies as groups of citizens who come together and do it on their own, make their own civil, non-governmental activities. And I think what we've seen too often is that too much of civil society has forgotten that civil society is not to be directed by the government. And by the same token, it must organize in order to defend rights through civil means rather than petitioning the government solely. That in fact, if you're setting up civil society in order to lobby the government and, what is so often the case, receive funding from the government in order to lobby the government, in fact, you're going to have compromises in the defense of civil and human rights. So civil society really needs to be civil society. Yes, it has a role in speaking to government, but it has just as much a role as organizing society in order to not be pressured into state-justified acts of abuse against the civil rights of other citizens. So, yes, civil society has a role. It has a role of not being government and not just existing there to be a minder of government, but to organize the strengthening of human and civil rights socially and through the cohesion of volunteer groups, of which I happen to say I am a big fan of the World Anti-Extremism Network, because it has taken that basic lesson to heart.
Thank you so much, Dr. Wayne, for joining us in today's podcast. I wish to have you again in our next programs, in our upcoming conference, to take advantage from extraordinary knowledge and also insightful opinions. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, sir.